Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Abraham is an important figure for us Christians, and those of you who don't look like images, don't look, but there's a rather good picture up there of Abraham just about to sacrifice his son, and for Jews and Christians it's Isaac that we understand was in that situation. So do have a quick look at him later on if you would like. I'm not going to talk about that incident, important as it is, because in some ways it's not absolutely central to the way in which Christians come at Abraham. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Abraham that we come across in the New Testament, in the Greek scriptures, which talk about Jesus. So I'm very, very grateful indeed to Maggie for having told us the long, convoluted story so quickly and in such detail in the Old Testament. But I'm just going to pick up a few thoughts that come to us from the New Testament. Let me just start with a couple of quick quotations from St. Luke's Gospel, because Abraham gets a mention very, very early on in that Gospel. Here's a quick few lines from a great hymn called the Magnificat, spoken by the Virgin Mary. God protects Israel, his servant, remembering his mercy, the mercy promised to our fathers, to Abraham and his sons forever. Okay, so that's the first mention we get of Abraham in St. Luke's Gospel. And then shortly afterwards, in a passage we call the Benedictus, which is another long, beautiful hymn praising God's work in the world, we hear these words. Through his holy prophets, God promised of old that he would save us, the Jews, from our enemies, from the hands of all who hate us. He promised to show mercy to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant. I really want to underline those words, his holy covenant. This was the oath he swore to our father Abraham, to set us free from the hands of our enemies, free to worship him without fear, holy and righteous in his sight all the days of our life. Okay, so those are the two quotations of scripture that I want to start with there. What do we learn from them? Well, I think you'll have heard very clearly that the stress is on the image of Abraham as our father, the father of Israel. And even more importantly than that, Abraham was the one to whom God made a promise. And Israel is the heir to that promise because we, the Jews, I'm not a Jew myself, I'm a Christian, but we, the Jews, God's chosen people, are the heirs of the promise made to Abraham. That promise has consequences down the generations, and now today we are the heirs to the promise. So very importantly, I think, Abraham is not just a prophet. You heard the word prophet there. It's not applied to Abraham in this situation. Abraham is the one to whom a promise has been entrusted. And the promise is the covenant made to the people of Israel. Now, the living question at the time of Jesus' life, because these two quotations from Luke's Gospel are timed just after Jesus' birth. Before, in one case. The Magnificat is spoken before Jesus' birth. The question at this time, I think, for the people of Israel is, how is God going to be faithful to this promise he's made us? Because, to remind you, the situation of the Jews at the time of Jesus' birth is catastrophic. They are under Roman occupation. There's a general sense that their religion has been corrupted, that the temple cult, the place where God is worshipped in Jerusalem, is not what it should be. There is not a kind of level of holiness and God consciousness that one would want. So in this situation, how can we talk about a God who is faithful to his promise to Israel, to be with them forever? That's the burning question at the beginning of the New Testament. So this covenant, there are 10 things that you need to know about the covenant, where it comes from, and the history of it. And I'm not going to give you a test afterwards, but see if you can remember these 10 thoughts about the covenant. First of all, the covenant is made with the aim of healing the whole world, reconciling a broken, sinful world to the God who created it and who wants to endow it with goodness. That's the first point. The covenant is made to bring healing to the world. Second point, the covenant is not made with the whole world, it's made with one single people, the people of Israel. Well, that's a rather astonishing thought, isn't it? One would have thought that God's way of healing the world was to make a covenant with the whole of the world. But in fact, the covenant is made with the Jews. And that's a very important, mysterious fact for Christians. Third, it's a covenant that is made in several stages. It's not static once for all. It develops and deepens and grows. So in the first instance, there's actually a kind of proto-covenant made with Noah. But then the fundamental one made with Abraham, renewed with Isaac, Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. Then Moses, very, very important moment, when the prophet Moses receives the law, the Torah. And then a continuing sense of deepening as that goes on. Fourth, it's based, first of all, on God's own promise, God's own word. And God's word is a promise of prosperity, it's a promise of land, it's a promise of fertility. God promises Abraham that his children will be as many as the stars. It's a promise to build Abraham's children into a vast nation. And then you heard it in the Benedictus there, there's a promise to keep Israel free from slavery. And that's really important because Israel is repeatedly dominated by other nations and finds itself in subjection. Who is this God who will free and liberate Israel? That's the burning question, as I've said, at the beginning of the New Testament. In return for that initial divine offer of land and prosperity, God asks the people to obey his law. Okay, that law relates very clearly to God's promise of land and prosperity. You can't separate them. You cannot just treat the Jewish law as a kind of general code of conduct for all human beings. It goes with that history of covenant and liberation given to the people of Israel. And they go together. That's really important for Christians for reasons I'll come to shortly. That's 4 points. Are you still with me? Nearly there. You're doing really well. Fifth, easy but important point, this covenant is meant to be a blessing for the whole world. It's not that Israel are God's favorites. He hasn't chosen them because they are chums. It's because God is going to do something among the people of Israel which will be a light for the whole world. All right, that's the mystery here of the election of one people, the children of Abraham. All right, God heals the world through his interaction with this one group of people. But it doesn't mean that they're his mates and he doesn't care about the rest. That's really important. Sixth point, how does the covenant work out in practice? I've told you about how it's sort of structured and how it gets off to a start. But how does it work out in practice? Answer, it is very rocky indeed. It's very rocky, ups and downs, like nobody's business. There are some very good experiences of the covenant, and the one that stands out is King David. He is a fantastic king. God doesn't have favorites, but my goodness, if he was going to have favorites, King David would probably be the one. The Old Testament tells a wonderful story of King David. He is it's the golden age of Israel, the high point of the covenant. But there are other kings too who keep to God's covenant. King Josiah, the last great king of Judea, is a wonderful example of faithfulness to the covenant. And there are a few others who I could talk about. Unfortunately, there are also some very grim pictures. Many kings who are unfaithful to God, under whom idolatry, the worship of foreign gods, is common. And so the covenant is no smooth ride. It's a story of success, but also of infidelity and failure. And the prophets, those great men who stand outside the city and judge the king and Israel according to their fidelity to the commandments. They tell a repeated story of Israel's infidelity. The culmination of this rocky covenant story is the famous exile in Babylon. This is our seventh point. Covenant eventually leads to a major crisis in which the elite of the Jewish establishment find themselves taken off to Babylon and forced to live under Gentile rule. It's a very, very painful experience in which they understand that God is still active, God is still with them, but teaching them a very difficult lesson about what the covenant means. The prophets understand, though, that God's anger will not be forever and that God will restore them one day to their home in Israel and restore the temple in Jerusalem. The covenant has not been finished. The covenant continues. God is faithful to his people. And some of the prophecies of the prophet Isaiah tell, you know, a beautiful story about a future restoration of Israel. It's a magnificent story of God's fidelity, a magnificent story of reconstruction and a kind of golden age still to come when Israel will be close to God and will be able to worship and serve him in holiness and justice. So you have that moment of purification in Babylon. Everything is stripped away and all Israel is given is its hope, a hope of God's fidelity. I think that's a really important moment, a very painful one, but very, very important for the story of Israel. Eighth point. We're doing really well here. You're still awake. I don't know if you're thinking about your shopping, but you're still looking at me as though you're listening. Thanks for that. Israel does return from exile. The temple is rebuilt in Jerusalem. Wonderful news. Is this the restoration that the prophet Isaiah and other prophets had talked about? There's a good question. Because in some ways you'd say, well, everything is back to normal. In other ways, things never really reach that climactic golden picture that the prophets speak of. It's all a bit humdrum. It's all a bit mundane. It's all a bit shabby, quite frankly. And then foreign invasions start again. It's hard to believe that this is the promised restoration that the people were looking forward to. And there's one really dark moment under a Greek emperor called Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the real villain of Jewish history. He sets up an idol in the great temple of Jerusalem. And this is a truly low point for the history of Israel. Things start to look as though God has really abandoned his people. If that happens, it's very, very hard to sense that God is still faithful to his people. Hope is being tested beyond limits, really. People are being pushed right to the edge. Ninth point. It's in a depth of almost despair, almost hanging on to a thread here now, that Jesus is born. And in the New Testament, you suddenly sense an explosion of new hope, because there's something about this birth that brings back to life the old hope. And the story that the New Testament tells now is that God is now visiting his people. God has really come back now to be with his people and to live up to all the promises he's made and to make them once again holy. It's impossible to read the New Testament without sensing a tremendous new light, a sense of expectation and hope. And particularly in Luke's Gospel, it reaches this wonderful climax when the young child Jesus enters the temple. Because this is one of the promises made in the Old Testament, that God will come back to his house. Very, very exciting. And you sense that in those two readings I began with from the New Testament. God is faithful to his promise. And after Israel has been through every dark moment you could imagine, that is truly invigorating.
Tenth point. Israel doesn't recognize what's happening. Some people do, but there are all sorts of people that you wouldn't expect. It's not the temple priesthood. It's not the high-ups and the elite who spot who Jesus is, who realize that God is being faithful to the promise of old, the promise made to Abraham. But it's outsiders, people in the margins, people from a place called Galilee, which is, frankly, I don't want to get personal about people in the UK. Where do you think life is a bit marginal? I'm not going to answer that question because you might be from there. But it's where important people don't come from. Yeah? Galilee is off the map. Those are the people who take Jesus seriously. Those are the people he chooses to be his disciples. So this is a story of things being turned upside down. You thought you knew who was holy, who was in tune with God. Well, it turns out not to be quite like that. And God ends up choosing people you would be very surprised to find at the center of God's saving action. And so God isn't quite ending the covenant with Israel, but it's moving into a new phase, a new surprising phase. And the really surprising thing about this new phase is the non-Jews, the Gentiles, the nations are welcome. This is very surprising. And it's part of the promise expressed by the prophet Isaiah that when God is finally faithful to his covenant, all the nations will come to worship God in Jerusalem. And do you remember I said that the promise made to Abraham was not just a promise to heal the Jews, but it was for the whole world. This is the moment when Jews and Gentiles sit down at table and eat together. This is the moment when a new community is formed in which there are no barriers between people. Finally, the covenant has been fulfilled in this man, Jesus, and out of him comes a new community, which we call the church. And that church is supposed to be a sign of God's healing in the world, a sign of everybody being gathered together to worship the one true God. And it's above all a sign that God was faithful to the promise he made to Abraham of old. So, that's what Abraham means for Christians. Somebody to whom a really important promise was made a long, long time ago, and the promise has been fulfilled finally in Jesus Christ. But there's just a little bit more of a twist. You thought the 10 facts about the covenant were going to be enough. I've got to add a final point, if I may. And it's a point brought up by Paul, one of the great writers of the New Testament. Because now a question arises, doesn't it? What holds this new community of Jews and Gentiles, Christians, together? It's not the law. It's not the land. It's not physical descent or circumcision, all the great symbols of God's covenant with Israel. It's not those things, because as I say, people like me, the Gentiles, we're now moving in. We're now taking our place in God's house. What's going to unite us? And the answer that Paul gives involves him looking back at Abraham and seeing something in there that hadn't been seen before. Because what Paul is going to say is that the new covenant, the covenant made with everybody through Jesus Christ, the new covenant is a covenant of faith. It's faith that unites all of these new people. And what does that word faith mean? Well, to explain what faith means, Paul looks back at Abraham, our father in faith, and that's how Christians will talk about Abraham, our father in faith. It's a certain quality that Abraham had that marked him out as different. And it goes back to this rather extraordinary trust that Abraham had. When he heard a voice out of nowhere say to him, Abraham, leave, well, Abraham, correctly, Maggie said that his name originally was Abraham, leave your father's house and go on a journey. If you heard a voice saying that, I bet you'd say, gosh, I think I'm going to get on with my shopping or whatever. You would ignore it or rationalize it away, because that's quite a threatening thing to hear. Leave everything that you know. Yeah, leave all the securities, leave your identity, and I'm going to do something new in your life. Abraham was quite old at this stage as well, even older than me. So leave it all behind and off you go, and just trust me. And Abraham, without saying anything at all, picks up his bags and off he goes. That is an image of faith, total trust in God. I was almost going to say unquestioning trust, but actually Abraham is a great man for asking questions. And at one point in his life, he really puts God on the spot about this whole business that Maggie talked about in Sodom. Asking God, you're not going to kill innocent people, are you? And he keeps going back to God and very, very determined that he's not going to be party to something in which innocent people die. Very impressive the way that God wrestles with God, the way that Abraham wrestles with God in a way. Very Jewish, that sense of interrogating and asking questions. So it's not an unquestioning faith, but it's a kind of freedom to go where God sends him. And I think that's what Paul is really impressed by in Abraham. And it becomes, I think, for Christians, a really important aspect of our own identity. We are people, we hope, though we don't always live up to this, who are prepared to go wherever God sends us. And you see that in the story of the first disciples of Jesus. Jesus just walks along the Sea of Galilee and says to people he apparently hasn't met before, drop your nets, stop fishing, leave your family and come and follow me. And they do, just like Abraham did. And then at one stage, it's becoming clear that Jesus has got too much work to do in terms of preaching to the people of Israel, so he sends these apostles off. You know, again, like Abraham, off you go. Go to these towns, preach my message, heal the sick, do all sorts of miracles in my name. And they do. They just trust what Jesus is telling them to do, just like Abraham did. And many Christians throughout history, all sorts of different Christians, Orthodox, Protestant, Catholic, they've all lived that same Abrahamic trust, Abrahamic faith, sensing God calling them to go and do all sorts of strange things in all sorts of different parts of the world, and they just leave everything and off they go. I think for us, Abraham is a sign, a symbol of that availability to God's will, which every Christian is called to live. So there you are. That's Abraham for us. The one to whom the great promise was made, the promise of a covenant fulfilled in Jesus Christ, and a man of faith, a man who was prepared to go off on an adventure, the adventure of faith, and in a very important way, a model for all of us. Thank you.